Taming a Shrew. In the village lived a woman named Yen Mu Hong, whom everyone called the Tigress, for she was unfilial to her parents-in-law, disrespectful towards her husband, impolite to her sisters, and rude to the neighbors. She didn't believe in ghosts and spirits, knew nothing of cause and effect, and continually indulged in offensive, antisocial behavior. Hearing of the master, she was curious and went to investigate. She found him sitting facing the west with his palms together reciting, "Namo Amitabha Buddha," without cease. Deeply impressed, she asked, "What are you doing?" "My parents toiled bitterly to raise me," the master replied, "and I wish to repay their kindness by reciting the Buddha's name so they may be reborn in the western land of ultimate bliss. That is my filial duty." She asked further, "Is it true that after death one may become a ghost?" The master said, "You don't have to wait until you die. If you think, speak, and act like a ghost now, you're a ghost in this very life. Wrathful people are red-faced ghosts, and spiteful people are yellow-faced ghosts. Those who annoy others are white-faced ghosts. Those who vex others are green-faced ghosts, and those who hate others are black-faced ghosts. If you conduct yourself like the five ghosts, you have five ghosts making noise in your house, and neither you nor your family will know any peace. You are certain, in fact, to lose your wealth and incur all kinds of calamities. Then, when you die, you will become a ghost and suffer endlessly in the great hells without escape, because you turn your back on enlightenment and became entangled with the dust of worldly affairs, deluded about the truth, and following the false, you bring retribution upon yourself. If you cultivate good and conquer evil, however, turning from the dust toward the truth, then you are identical with the Buddhas. Neither born nor destined to die, neither defiled nor pure, and neither increasing nor decreasing. Such is the immutable, eternally bright reward of bliss. You will have escaped the cycle of rebirth and ended tens of thousands of eons of birth and death." Surprised and frightened, the woman began to cry. "I never knew what it meant to be a human being," she said, "and that one must act responsibly and practice good deeds. Ignorant of cause and effect, I have acted carelessly. But now I realize that my guilt is truly limitless and am deeply sorry. I feel, however, that my repentance is too late. What can I do?" The master said, "That you admit your former errors is a sign that your natural goodness has come to the fore. Your tears are of no use. Besides, people are people, not saints. Who can have no faults at all? Your crimes may fill heaven and earth, but if you truly repent, they are all eradicated. Confess openly, reform, and then consider your past actions as if you had died yesterday and been born again today. If, as a laywoman, you vow to spread the Buddha Dharma and encourage people to take refuge with the Triple Jewel, your merit and virtue will wipe those offenses away. Don't you know that when great evil is reformed, it becomes great good, whereas one of great goodness who commits offenses becomes one of great evil?" The woman was overjoyed at the instructions, took refuge with the master, and worked diligently to promote the Dharma, converting over 800 people to become his disciples. Having awakened to the great vehicle, she upheld the proper dharma, and the villagers no longer called her the tigress, but spoke of her as the guiding Guanyin. Toward the end of the eighth lunar month, in the autumn of 1944, she said to her relatives, "I have redeemed my great offenses through acts of virtue. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are pleased. Our teacher, the Venerable Master, has come into the world through the power of the great vows of Amitabha Buddha. Believe in him. If you don't waste your time and don't backslide, you are certain to obtain great advantage and arrive at the other shore, which is Nirvana. I have learned from the Master that the 19th day of the 9th month is the date of my departure for the Pure Land. Do not grieve, but assist me in reciting the Buddha's name." Her family agreed, and on the appointed day, she bathed, dressed, and sat in full lotus facing the west. With palms together and a smile on her face, she died reciting the Buddha's name. She was 69 years old and had eaten pure food and recited the Buddha's name for over 10 years. The Allegiance of a Scholar. Gu Jie-san, who had been a top-ranking imperial scholar during the late Qing Dynasty, was a man of rare literary talents and the teacher of many well-known scholars. Although he investigated the Buddha Dharma, he had been unable to grasp its essential doctrines, and so he visited the Master and requested instruction. The Master taught him the fundamentals of Dhyana meditation, the mind-ground Dharma door, which is not based on language. Understanding what he had never understood before, Gu Jie-san was overjoyed. He reverently practiced the Master's teaching, and in 1943, he died sitting with his body in full lotus position and his face showing a great luster. The Villagers See Light. The Master's 3-year mourning period was about to expire. One evening at twilight, the residents of the nearby village saw a brilliant light ascend from the Master's hut. It rose some 30 feet in the air, illumining the entire area as bright as day. In alarm, they cried, "The filial son's hut is on fire! Is he alive or dead? We must go put it out." They ran to the graveyard, found the tiny hut as peaceful as ever, with the Master sitting upright by the light of a single oil lamp reciting the Buddha's name. In deep admiration, they said among themselves that the Master had truly attained the way as revealed through the great beam of light. The Master's following increased greatly from that, and visitors came from hundreds of miles to receive his teaching and pay their respects. Finally, when his filial duties were completed, he went into seclusion in Amitabha Cave in the mountain east of the district. There, he deeply delved into Dhyana meditation and practiced rigorous asceticism, eating only pine nuts and drinking spring water. The area abounded with wild beasts, but they never disturbed the Master. In fact, wolves and bears behaved like house pets. Tigers stopped and listened to his teaching, and wild birds gathered to hear the wonderful Dharma. Those are all indications that the Master's level of attainment had already gone far beyond that which our ordinary minds can grasp, and that he had entered an inconceivable state. Stopping the Cycle. By the time he had completed the 3-year mourning period, the Master had received over 2,000 visitors from all walks of life, scholars, farmers, workers, merchants, and officials. Only beggars were absent from this throng. Then one day, Ji Da Fu called at the master's hut. "Venerable master," he asked, "why am I so poor?" The master explained to him the principle of cause and effect. Why is one wealthy in one's present life? It is because one practiced giving in lives past. Why is one poor in one's present life? It is because one never aided the poor in lives past. "When I search my heart," said the beggar, "I find no cause for shame, and yet in order to live I must beg in the streets. If that is the result of my past greed and selfishness, how can the cycle be stopped?" "It is not difficult," said the master. "You need only sincerely believe and diligently practice, and you will obtain results." Long ago there was a man named Zhu Qi who, understanding the principle of the cycle of retribution, exerted himself in doing acts of virtue and built the Shuangshan Bridge. In his next life he was reborn in the imperial family and enjoyed the prosperity and glory of a prince. Wouldn't you call that stopping the cycle? The beggar happily bowed, took refuge, and from that day on, while begging, he recited Namo Amitabha Buddha without cease. Any leftover food he always gave to the less fortunate. He practiced charity with all his might for many years, perfecting his virtue and purifying his karma until, in 1930, he foretold his own death, and sitting in the lotus position facing west, he died while reciting the Buddha's name. Part 5. From Student to Teacher. Wonderful Dharma. One word makes all the difference. It is a New Year's custom in China to write matched couplets. The verses are written on festive strips and displayed on both sides of the entrances to homes, businesses, and even temples. One year, when the master was still a novice, he wrote the four words, "Wisdom like the sea," as part of a New Year's greeting. When a fellow novice saw the characters, he was fascinated and began to repeat them again and again. "Wisdom like the sea, wisdom like the sea, wisdom like the sea." The master listened for a while but finally became annoyed and said, "Your karma is like the sea." The master's words enraged the novice. He screamed at the master, "What do you mean my karma is like the sea?" And he began to dance around the master like a boxer. "Hey, hey, hey," said the master, "wait a minute. Don't get nervous. I'm going to tell you something which is bound to please you. I said your karma was like the sea. Instead of getting angry, you really should thank me." "You said my karma was like the sea," said the novice, "and you expect me to thank you? Nothing doing." "Let me finish explaining," said the master. "Do you know what karma is? It's just what people do. There is both good and bad karma. When I said that your karma was like the sea, I was referring to your good karma. Why are you angry? What do you think about that?"
No problem," said the novice. "No problem." And he invited the master to lunch.
On another occasion, the master, then a novice, was carrying a roll of paper when suddenly another Dharma brother called to him.
"What are you carrying? What have you got there?"
Hey, you, what's that?
He felt it his duty to make sure that nothing got lost or wasted.
This, said the master, it's a bill of sale. You see, I just sold you, and this is the receipt.
The novice, who had a quick temper, was furious.
What? He screamed. Just what makes you think you have the right to sell me? Who do you think you are? What business of it is yours to sell me?
I have every right to sell you, the master replied, and what is more, you're going to be happy I did so.
If it weren't going to make you happy, I wouldn't have told you about it.
What right do you have? Just what right? The novice sputtered.
I have the right to sell you to someone who can make you happy, said the master. In fact, I've sold you to Shakyamuni Buddha. I have done it so that you can always be a bhikshu.
The novice was speechless.
Well, said the master, can I do that or not? Are you happy now?
Oh, yes, yes, you can do that, said the novice. That's all right.
Big knees. In Lalin, in the village of Beiyinhe, lived Guan Zhengxi and his nephew, Guan Zhanghai. Guan Zhengxi had been a non-Buddhist teacher and transmitted a dharma called the Way of Gathering Conditions. He told his disciples that he had hundreds of treasures for sale at only $1,000 each. The treasures existed in name only, and Guan Zhengxi said, "The time is not right, and so I can't give them to you now. When the time comes, the world will change and you will have your treasures." He had over 4,000 disciples. When he reached 50 years of age, he realized that in spite of his wealth, he had nothing precious with which to protect his own life. Knowing that he was close to death and afraid to die without first understanding how to cultivate the way, he went with his nephew to search for a good knowing advisor, one with the five eyes and the six spiritual penetrations who could teach him the fundamentals of dhyana meditation. For 3 years they wandered together visiting famous dharma masters in well-known monasteries and great scholars in the academies. They sought out hermits in lonely mountain caves, but found no one who could teach them dhyana. Sad and disappointed, they returned. One day the master went down the mountain to buy some oil, incense, and candles. On the way to town, he stopped to rest at Guan Zhengxi's house. When the nephew saw the master, he was astonished. Pulling his uncle aside, he asked,
"Who is that monk? Last night I dreamed that he came here and sat on the brick bed. I knelt before him and begged him to teach us the way. In the dream, he said, 'You have a pig skin on your body which must come off before you can cultivate.' And he peeled a layer of skin off my body and threw it on the ground. It was a pig skin."
"You aren't vegetarian," the master said, "and you eat pork. In the future, you will have a pig skin on your back."
I was scared stiff and said to him, "Oh no, pigs are filthy and useless." "I had the dream last night and now the monk is actually here. Is it a lucky sign or not?"
His uncle was excited.
"Really?" he said. "Did you really have that dream?"
"Of course it's a lucky sign. The monk is the Venerable Master Dulin, filial son Bai. I've wished to bow to him for a long time, and now he's come here."
"It is true, then, that he has the way, and he's brought it to our house."
After talking, they went into the room where the master was sitting, closed the door, and bowed.
"Have you both gone insane?" said the master. "What do you want from me? I'm just the same as you. I don't understand the way."
We know you cultivate filial piety, said the uncle, and that you have come to show us the way. Last night my nephew dreamed you peeled a pigskin off his body.
You're confused, said the master. He's not a pig. How could I peel a pigskin off him?
I can't teach you to cultivate, but if you want to find a teacher, I can help you look.
We've looked everywhere, they said, but we haven't found one.
Wherever we go, it's always the same. They all have a lot of name and fame, but not genuine virtue.
During the next 2 years, the master sent them everywhere to meet all kinds of cultivators and good-knowing advisors. They continually insisted on taking the master as their teacher, but the master was still a young novice and didn't want any disciples. Finally, they knelt before him and refused to get up.
It's useless to talk about whether or not I have the way, the master said. First learn to sit in full lotus, and then I will teach you.
They practiced sitting every day. The nephew had no trouble, but the uncle's bones were old, and in northeast China, the mountain people have big kneecaps, which stick up about 15 inches in the air when they try to sit cross-legged. But the uncle kept trying. He pushed his knees down over and over, and in 70 days, he finally managed to sit in full lotus. When the master returned, he noticed that the uncle's legs were swollen. They were so sore, in fact, that he couldn't even step over a cart rut.
You shouldn't sit in full lotus, the master told him.
Are you still practicing?
I am.
You shouldn't continue, said the master.
What do you mean? Said the uncle.
I'm about to die, and if I don't practice now, what will I do then?
No matter what, I'm going to practice meditation. If I die, that's another matter. But as long as I'm still alive, I'm going to practice.
Do what you like, said the master, and he left.
When he returned 100 days later, he noticed that the uncle's legs were no longer swollen.
You're not still sitting, are you?
He asked. Guan Zhengxi smiled. I can sit in full lotus now, and no matter how long I sit, it doesn't hurt, and my legs don't swell.
Now, said the master, I'll teach you how to work.
And he instructed them, saying, Why don't living beings attain the way? It is because of the false mind which disturbs the true nature and binds them to their passions. Defiled by greed, frustration, and discursive thought, they get caught in the flow of birth and death. They sink into the sea of suffering and lose the way. But although the sea of suffering is boundless, a turn of the head is the other shore. Always be alert and watchful in meditation, like a chicken watching its eggs, or a dragon guarding its pearl. By and by, you will get good news. The uncle was incredibly happy and sat in meditation every day. When his death approached, he gathered his family together and said, On such and such a day, at such and such a time, I'm going to leave. I'm going to die. The only thing I still desire is to see my teacher once again, but I don't know where he is now, and so I cannot see him. Then, on the appointed day, he sat upright in full lotus and without any illness died. That evening, many of the villagers had the same dream. They dreamed that they saw the uncle accompanied by two youths in dark robes being taken to the west. Later, the nephew insisted on formally taking the master as his teacher. He followed the master down the road until they entered a clearing. Then suddenly he knelt, clutched the master's sleeve, and begged to become a disciple.
The master brushed him off and left, while the boy pleaded, saying he would not get up unless he was allowed to become a disciple. The boy was truly filial and always respected his teacher, and although his family wasn't rich, every New Year's he gave the master a gift. He was deeply sincere, and because of his dream about the pig skin, he believed the master to be a living bodhisattva. While the master and Great Master Chongren were collecting offerings for the purpose of building temples, it was often the case that people who had never seen the master would have a dream in which the master clearly appeared. The following day, much to their astonishment, the master would invariably show up at their home on his rounds. Recognizing the master as the bhikshu they had seen in their dreams, they would be extremely respectful towards him and deeply believed in him, and they were generous in their assistance in raising funds. This was a common occurrence. The Buddha has come. About 30 miles from Three Conditions Temple, in a little village called Hoxinglong, there lived one Changshan Ren, Good Man Chang. As a youth, he had set his great intelligence aside in order to smoke opium and gamble his servants' salary away from them. At age 40, he took refuge with the old abbot Chongren. After taking refuge, he changed his evil habits and cultivated merit and virtue so industriously that he was soon known throughout the area as Good Man Chang. Those without food could always go to him for wheat and rice. One year, one of his servants became possessed by a demon. Insane, he tried to set fire to Chang's house and granaries, intent on destroying his family and household. Finally, on New Year's Eve, Good Man Chang went to Three Conditions Temple and begged Abbot Chongren for help. He truly believed in the old abbot. The abbot sent for the master. "He asked you to help him," the master said to the abbot. "Why give the trouble to me?" "He's one of our good Dharma protectors," replied the abbot. "Won't you see what you can do?" As the old abbot and the master were like one person, the master agreed, and at Chang's house, he sat on the high brick bed, facing the servant. The servant threw his hands over his face. He himself had no idea he had been possessed. "What are you doing?" said the master. "I can't see," cried the servant. "I can't see anything but light. Don't you see it?" The servant stared and knelt before the master. "Why are you kneeling?" the master asked. "The Buddha has come," said the servant. And in a moment, he was better, the demon gone. The Wise Yo. In Manchuria, the master had a friend and fellow cultivator who had been a thief. He had changed his evil ways, however, and gone to practice filial piety beside his parents' graves. While cultivating, he opened a bit of wisdom, and his teacher gave him the name Wise Yo. What made him change from a thief into a cultivator? Once, while stealing, someone caught him and shot him in the arm. Such a wound normally would have healed in a month, but after a year, his still hadn't. Because of that, he repented. "Ah," he said, "I was a thief and someone shot me. I'm lucky even to be alive." "But why is the wound taking so long to heal?" Then he made a vow. "If the wound heals within a week, I will never steal again. I will go to sit beside my parents' grave as an act of filial piety." Strangely enough, by the end of the week his wound had completely healed, and so he went off to cultivate filial piety. The master said, Children practice filial piety to show that they have not forgotten their parents' kindness in raising them. What is the use of a living person sitting beside a grave? It has no use at all, unless you are able to do it. If you can do it, it is very meaningful because it is a difficult practice. Traditionally, one sits for 3 years. People 40 or 50 years old, whose minds are more settled, find it easier than younger people who find it extremely difficult. There's no one to talk to, no one to help you out. It's a great deal of suffering. At that time, filial son Yo was only 21 years old. His teacher, Zong Yi, a master of great virtue and spiritual power, taught him how to sit in meditation, and filial son Yo worked hard. Then, while he was sitting, a demon came, a fiery dragon. It wound itself around him 3 times and scorched him hotter and fiercer every minute until his teacher finally defeated it and took it as a disciple. After that, the dragon became filial son Yo's Dharma protector. Once, after he had been practicing for 2.5 years, it rained for over a month and washed out all the newly planted fields. Fearing that people would starve, filial son Yo made another vow. If the sky clears within 3 days, I will cut off a piece of my own flesh as an offering to the Lord of Heaven. Because he had not yet studied the Buddha Dharma, he wanted to make an offering to God. In less than 3 days, the sky cleared, and filial son Yo cut off a piece of his flesh. The first time he tried, it didn't come off, and so he cut again, and then again, and finally succeeded in cutting off about 1 pound of flesh. He fell to the ground unconscious, while the blood flowed over an area of 4 feet, staining the soil bright red. Before he passed out, a visitor ran to inform the government, and the government sent an official to investigate and take part in the offering to heaven. Many people were greatly influenced by filial son Yo's act and recognized him as a great bodhisattva. After that, people flocked to see him. A bird also became his friend. The tiny bird could talk, but all it would say was, "Do more virtuous deeds. Do more virtuous deeds. The more virtuous deeds you do, the better." Just like an old friend, the bird would perch on his head, hands, and shoulders and didn't fear him in the least. He helped filial son Yo do his work and meditate, and sometimes the two of them cracked jokes and had a great deal of fun. But when visitors came, the bird always flew off and would only return again when they had left. When 3 weeks had passed and filial son Yo's wound had healed, the bird left for good. When his 3 years of filial piety had expired, the Way Virtue Association invited him to join and give lectures. He was a powerful speaker and taught countless people about the qualities of virtue, humaneness, propriety, and so forth. At that time, Chinese people didn't grow long hair or beards, but as a filial son, Wise Yo had let his hair and beard grow so that he looked much like the present-day hippies. He did not take drugs, however. He ate pure vegetarian food, recited the Buddha's name, and spoke true principle. Filial sons let their hair and beards grow to accord with the line in the classic of filial piety which says, "Our bodies, skin, and hair came from our parents. Not harming the body is in accord with the way." Not being destructive in your own body is the beginning of filial piety. So you may wonder, if he protected his long hair and beard, why did he cut off a piece of his own flesh? Is that filial? Wouldn't his parents have cried had they seen him do such a thing? Filial Sanyo cut off his flesh, seeking a response from the Lord in heaven for the benefit of all. At that time, he was unfamiliar with the classic of filial piety. He had heard that people practiced filial conduct by sitting beside their parents' graves, and so he also did it. Then, afraid that people might go hungry, he simply decided to sacrifice his own flesh in order to save them. With that one true, sincere thought, he sacrificed what others cannot sacrifice, and so obtained a response. While lecturing at the Way Virtue Association, Filial Sanyo heard about the master who was also cultivating filial piety and who was known as Filial Sun Bai. Filial Sanyo had been a bit arrogant, thinking, "I'm only 21 years old, and yet I'm cultivating filial piety." When he heard that the master was only 19, he felt he had been outdone and decided he simply must meet the master. The master also wished to meet Filial Sanyo, and one day he happened to visit the Way Virtue Association. He recognized Filial Sanyo at once by his long hair and beard. The master himself had shaved his head. "You must be Good Man Yo," said the master. "And who are you?" said Filial Sanyo. "You don't know me?" The master replied, "But I know you. In fact, I don't know who I am. You probably know who you are, but I don't know who I am." Filial Sanyo was startled. "Really?" he exclaimed. Then someone introduced them, and Filial Sanyo said, "Where did you come from?" "I come from where I came," said the master. Filial Sanyo found his answer truly strange. Then the master asked, "And where are you going?" "I'm not going anywhere," said the filial son. "Then why did you ask me where I came from?" said the master. And the filial son grabbed his hand, delighted. The account of their meeting was told everywhere. The master had said, "There's no place to come from and no place to go, neither coming nor going, and yet coming and going. One comes from where one comes and goes to where one goes." One of the Buddha's 10 titles is Thus Come One. The Diamond Sutra says, "Because he comes from nowhere and goes nowhere, he is called the Thus Come One." When they first saw each other, neither the filial Sanyo nor the filial Sanbai spoke. But then Filial Sanyo became curious and asked the master where he had come from. The moment he asked, the master relates, he knew he made a mistake. "Why?" "Open your mouth and you're wrong. Think up a thought and you're mistaken. Anything that can be spoken is not the actual principle. That which can be spoken is not the ultimate dharma. The ultimate dharma is neither spoken nor transmitted. It should be viewed like that." The Resurrection. When asked by the Venerable Master Shinran to assist in building a temple, the master went to the village of Shida-ju to borrow wagons in order to haul materials to the building site, but no one was willing to help. When he spoke with the mayor, Liu Zhengqian, the mayor replied, "I am sorry, but right now we are extremely busy planting fields and need every available wagon." That morning, the mayor's sister-in-law's child died, She brought the child to the master and asked, "Why did my child die? He was good and obedient." "Have you been filial to your parents-in-law?" asked the master. "No doubt you haven't, and so your child has died. If you would like him back, bow to them and admit your errors. Then I will make your child live again." Seeing her hesitate, the master added, "I'm not kidding. Why would I joke about something like that? Go try it out." She went to her husband's family and bowed. "It's true," she said. "I haven't been filial, and so my child has died." Soon the entire family was crying and apologizing. When she returned home, she ran to her child, but found him still dead. "Is he better?" asked the master. "No," she said. "Give him to me," said the master. He took the child in his arms, patted it firmly on the head 3 times, and the child began to cry. He was completely well. The entire household took refuge with the master, and then the whole village took refuge too. When the mayor got word, he said, "You asked to use our carts. You may take them all. We will all help you build the temple." After that, wherever he went, people fought to lend the master a cart.
Then the trouble came.
"My mother is sick," said one. "Couldn't you help her?" Another said, "My uncle is not well." In all cases, the master exhausted his strength to cure the sick. "You have worked for the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas," he would say, "and they will certainly take care of you. From today on, your sickness will be healed." In each case, as soon as he spoke, they were cured. Within a month, over 800 carts were available for his use. It was winter, and the master rose at 3 in the morning and went to work in the snow, wearing only 3 layers of cotton clothing. When people saw him, they would exclaim, "He only eats 1 meal a day, and he's still not afraid of the cold. Incredible!" When Li Qingshan heard of the miraculous recovery of the Liu child, he respectfully asked the master to cure his little brother. When the master entered the house, he said, "The house is too full of darkness. There is nothing I can do. Within a few days, a great misfortune will occur." Towards the end of the week, Li Qingshan quarreled with his brother and committed suicide. His brother and daughter died shortly thereafter. The villagers said that the master had knowledge of the future, but the master made no reply. The method. The master accompanied the great master Changren, encouraging people to make offerings of charity. The two of them went everywhere. Once they passed through a country village, and just as they were about to enter the house of Mr. Wong, he grabbed his child and knelt before them in the doorway, begging them to save his child's life. His child had tuberculosis and coughed up blood, and his stomach and head ached. Hearing his request, Great Master Changren said, "Ask Dharma Master Anzi. He can help you." The master replied, "The man asked you to help him. Why do you give your work to me?" The abbot insisted, however, and so the master agreed. Then he asked Mr. Wong a strange question. "Do you want your son to live?" "I am unable to save him. You must save him yourself." "I want him to live," said Mr. Wong. "But how can I save him? I don't know how." "Here is the method," said the master.
If you want him to live, you must allow him to leave the home life and become a bhikshu. If he leaves home, he will live. If he does not, he will surely die. There are no two ways about it. The child was 11 years old at the time. Mr. Wong's wife agreed to the conditions and the master repeated them. If your child leaves home, from this very day he will not cough blood, and his stomach and head will be cured, he said. How do you feel? They asked the boy. Better. In fact, I feel fine. The child was completely well. Although the master advised Mr. Wong on several occasions to bring his son to the temple, Mr. Wong did not do so. The master waited 2 or 3 months. One day, as he was walking along the outskirts of the village, the child, sitting at home, was aware of his proximity. Father, my teacher came to our village today, but he did not stop at our house. He is probably unhappy with us. From that day, the child relapsed and his sickness was worse than before. A week later, his father went to the temple, but the master wasn't there. And since none of the other people understood the situation, no one could help him. Arriving home, his son said, I went with you to the temple today and saw every room and know who lives where. One room was hung with banners for the dead. Strange, said his father. Your mother says you were here all the time. How could you have gone with me to the temple? A few days later, the master was again walking on the outskirts of town, returning to the temple, and the child knew. My teacher is returning to the temple. He's not stopping here. Please follow his instructions and let me leave home right away. Go and see him immediately. Wait until tomorrow, said his father. I'll go then. You don't have to go, said the boy. Even if you went this minute, it wouldn't make any difference. That evening, at dusk, the child sat up in bed. Father, light the lamp and tell me if I am sitting correctly. His father lit the lamp and looked at his son, who was sitting serene and upright in full lotus. He was dead. No matter how hard his father and mother cried, the child didn't come back to life. They begged the master to make him live again, but the master said, The method was yours, not mine. I gave it to you, but you didn't use it. There is nothing more I can do. Why did the master instruct the child to leave home? It was because he had the appearance of a bhikshu, and in past lives he had made vows to leave home in every life. An outstanding example. In Shuangcheng District, Sanxing Village, lived a man named Yan Yu Kun, whose third son Xiao Ying was a colonel in the army. When Xiao Ying's regiment was stationed in Sanjiang Province in 1942, he took his mother and sister there to live with him. His sister, Xu Lan, had not yet married, and soon Xiao Ying arranged her betrothal to Colonel Bai. On the day before the wedding, Xu Lan suddenly fell ill and for several days lay unconscious in bed. One day, she suddenly said to her mother, The white-robed Guan Yin is coming. Quick, light incense as an offering. And then she rose and prostrated herself before the altar. Her moving lips showed that she was speaking with someone. And at length she gestured as if saying a respectful farewell to an honored guest. Then she turned to her mother, saying, Guan Yin has just told me that my illness will be cured if I do not marry, but leave the home life and cultivate the way. She has agreed that I may leave the home life after the death of my parents. Tomorrow, a Dharma master will come to heal me. Her mother was pleased. And the following day, the gong before Shulan's altar spontaneously sounded 3 times. Just then, a Dharma master entered the room. Wearing a monk's cap and rag robe, he was barefoot and carried the white whisk brush, which is used to dispel illness. He appeared in this manner 3 times daily for 9 days. Finally, he said, "Shulan, can you leave the home life without any doubts?" "When I am well," she said, "I shall most certainly leave home to cultivate." The master then handed her a pill. She swallowed it and recovered immediately. While Shulan was dangerously ill, her mother had wired her father. When he arrived, she was well, and he scoffed when he heard the events surrounding her recovery. "No doubt they are just hallucinations brought on by a high fever. They are nothing but the products of her delirium. For how else could an ordinary human being see a bodhisattva?" Hearing his words, Shulan herself doubted her experiences and returned to Sanxing village with her father and mother. Later, she had a dream in which Maitreya Bodhisattva said, "Your father will die within 7 days. Recite the Buddha's name to lessen his offenses." When she told her father the next day, he did not believe her. Against his daughter's protests, on the 6th day after the dream, he set out for Shuangcheng, where he bought some things. He went to the railroad station to buy his return ticket, and just as he entered the gate, he suddenly fainted. The police informed the Yang family, and by the time Shulan's father was carried home, he was dead. That happened exactly 7 days after her dream. Shulan's other brother, Shi Chao, not only obstructed his daughter's attempts to leave home, but slandered the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha as well. One night he dreamed that a bodhisattva spoke to him saying, "In a month you will die." He awoke surprised but did not repent and died within a month. On the 13th day of the 5th month, 1945. That year, on the 25th day of the 12th month, the master paid a special visit to Shulan's house. The moment she saw the master, Shulan exclaimed, "Mother, the Dharma master who cured my illness in Sanjiang province has now come here." She rose to greet him and bowed reverently. The master said, "So you still recognize me?" "Yes," said the girl. "Do you still wish to leave the home life?" He asked, "Before, in my confusion, I didn't understand. I had no proof, and so I doubted," she replied. "Now I know it's true. The master has manifested as a bodhisattva to cure my illness. I am determined to leave home. How could there be any question?" From that time on, Shulan ate a strict vegetarian diet and constantly recited the Buddha's name. She set an outstanding example among her peers and convinced her 3 brothers and many of her relatives, the young and well-educated, of the truth of Buddhism. They all took refuge with the Triple Jewel and bowed to the master as their teacher. A white fox seeks refuge. In Shuangcheng District, in the 4th district of Xiangbaiqi, was a family named Xia, which supported a fox immortal named Hu Tianbai and his retinue of over 300. The immortal dispensed medicines and used all manner of spiritual powers to save people, and sometimes transformed himself into an old man in order to give the townspeople good advice and exhort them to practice virtue. Thus, he was admired by the community. One day, he addressed his assembly as follows: "In 3 years, I shall take refuge with the Buddhist Triple Jewel and follow my compassionate teacher in cultivating the way." When 3 years had passed, the master arrived as prophesied, and the immortal and his retinue took refuge with the proper teaching. They cultivated merit and virtue with great vigor and upheld the Dharma, teaching many living beings how to leave suffering and attain bliss. A heavenly demon takes refuge with the Triple Jewel. On the 12th day of the second month, in the year of 1945, the master passed through the Zhou family station in northeast China. In the town there was a Way Virtue Association, which met daily for lectures on the Way and its virtue. Because many of the members were the master's disciples, whenever he traveled near that town, he stayed for a few days. This time the master met a Chinese astrologer named Zhou who cast his horoscope. The astrologer said, "You should be an official. Why have you left home? Had you wanted to, you could have been a great official." "I haven't any idea how to be an official," the master said, "but I do know how to be a Buddhist bhikshu, and so I have left home." "What a pity," said the astrologer, and he looked at the master's hand. "At the very least," he said, "you could have been a top-ranking imperial scholar." "No," said the master, "I couldn't even have come in last." "Oh," the astrologer added, "this year something very lucky will happen to change your life. After the 10th or 12th of next month, things will be different. Right now, all the people within 350 miles believe in you, but after the 10th of the next month, everyone within 3,500 miles will believe in you." "How is that?" asked the master. "When the time comes, you will know," he said. 2 days later, the master went to the village of Xiangbaiqi, 4th district, and stayed with his disciple, Xia Zunxiang, who was over 60 years old. Mr. Xia was the richest landowner in the area and had never believed in Buddhism until he saw the master and immediately decided to take refuge with him. He and his family of over 30 people all took refuge, and every time the master visited them, they were extremely happy. On this occasion, the master stayed for 10 days, and in that time, 72 people took refuge. On the 25th, the master set out in Mr. Xia's cart for the city of Shuangcheng. Although it was early spring, the weather was bitter cold. The driver and the attendant were dressed in fur coats, trousers, and hats, but the master wore only his usual rag robe of 3 layers of thin cotton cloth. Trousers made of 2 layers of cloth, open arhat sandals with no socks, and a pointed hat that didn't cover his ears. They rode from 3 in the morning until dawn, arriving in Shuangcheng at 7 in the morning. The attendant and the driver had stopped repeatedly to exercise and keep warm, but the master had remained in the cart. When they arrived and the master got out of the cart, the driver exclaimed, "We thought surely you had frozen to death." The master stayed with friends, Dharma-protecting laymen, for a few days, and on the 9th day of the 3rd month, he returned to Xia Zunxiang's home in Xiangbaiqi. Upon arriving, he was told that one of his recent disciples, the daughter of Xia Wanshan, had fallen dangerously ill. She hadn't eaten, slept, or drunk water for over a week. She did not speak, and she looked fiercely angry as if she wanted to beat people. Then her mother came. "Master," she said, "my daughter became very ill less than a week after taking refuge," and she described her illness. The master said, "I can't cure her, but my disciple Han Gangji has opened the five eyes and can know people's past, present, and future affairs. You should ask him. Han Gangji had also taken refuge in Shuangcheng on the 24th of the second month. At first, the master had refused to take him as a disciple, because before the master had left home, the two of them had been good friends and had worked together in the Way Virtue Association. After the master left home and Han Gangji opened his five eyes, he looked at the master and saw that life after life, the master had always been his teacher. "But if I don't take refuge with you, I know that in this life I shall certainly fall," Han Gangji said, and he knelt on the ground determined to take refuge. The master was just as determined not to accept him, but Han knelt for perhaps a half an hour when the master finally said, "Those who take refuge with me must offer up their conduct in accord with the teaching. You have talent. You know the past, present, and future. Is it possible that it has caused you to become arrogant? Will your pride prevent you from obeying instructions?"
"Master," he said, "I will certainly obey. If you tell me to throw myself into a cauldron of boiling soup, I'll do it. If you tell me to walk on fire, I'll walk. I'll stand at my post and not resign. If I get boiled or burned to death, that's all right."
"You'd better be telling the truth," said the master. "If I give you instructions, you can't ignore them."
"No matter what it is," he said, "if you tell me to do it, I will do it, and fear no danger whatever."
And so Han Gangji was one of the 72 who took refuge on the 24th. When the master heard that one of his disciples was sick, he told Han Gangji, "You can diagnose illnesses. Take a look." Han Gangji sat in meditation and made a contemplative examination of the illness. Suddenly, his face blanched with terror.
"Master," he said, "we can't handle this one. It's beyond our control. The demon who is causing the illness is extremely violent and can assume human form to bring chaos into the world and injury to humankind."
"What makes the demon so fierce?" asked the master. "The demon was a ghost long ago in the Zhou Dynasty," he said. "Because it didn't behave properly, a man with spiritual powers shattered it with thunder. But the ghost's spirit did not completely disperse, and it later fused into a powerful demon which could fly and vanish and appear at will. The demon has refined some Dharma treasures," he continued. "The first is an exclusive anti-thunder device, a black hat made out of human afterbirth. Thunder has a great aversion to filth. She also has two round balls. When she hits someone with one of them, he immediately dies. If she puts her hat on someone, his mind falls under her control, and he becomes one of her retinue."
"Master, we can't manage such a fierce demon."
"Then what will become of the sick girl?" the master asked. "She will certainly die," he said. "If she weren't my disciple, I'd pay no attention, but she took refuge with me, so I can't allow the demon to take her life."
"You take care of it then," said Han Gangji.
"But I'm not going."
"What?" said the master. "You said you would jump into the soup, walk on fire, and stay at your post without resigning. It's not even soup or fire. Why have you suddenly decided to resign?"
Han Gangji thought it over. "If you appoint some Dharma protectors to take care of me," he said.
"Don't shilly-shally," said the master. "If you're going to go, go, but don't wobble."
When they arrived, they saw the girl lying on the bed with her head and knees on the bed and the rest of her body sticking up in the air at an absurd angle. Her eyes were as wide as those of an ox, and she glared with rage at the master. The master asked the girl's family, "What is the cause of this illness?"